Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 20 of NML Crossing, where we are crossing the finish line on our fourth week, which that's pretty cool. Now, apropos of very, very little. I don't even know why I'm sharing this, but I'm trying something a little bit different with the setup today. This might not be relatable to folks who don't spend hours upon hours a week talking to themselves into a microphone in an empty room, but I'm finding that I tend to kind of contort my body in certain ways to, like, I don't trust the microphone. A friend of mine actually reached out to me about a week ago, and he said that on one of the devices he listens on, the volume on this program is very low, which I know, like, my setup is very, very unprofessional. It's wildly unprofessional. It's basically a step up from me holding, like, an empty soup can with a string attached to it, you know? So he said that it was low, and I think that since hearing that, I've been trying to, not trusting the microphone, and I'm, like, contorting, so I'm, like, talking, like, right into, I mean, you're supposed to talk into a microphone, obviously, but I feel like I'm insisting upon the microphone, I guess. So my mic is a Blue Yeti, and I have it sitting on, like, a little corkboard trivet that I got from IKEA. Just so, you know, the many, many times that I talk with my hands and I slap the desk a lot, so it kind of muffles that. It's not like a giant ping every time I accidentally swipe at the desk. And my desk is a folding card table that I found in the garage. It's, like I said, this is Campbell's soup can with a string, basically. But right now, my big improvement is that I have the microphone, corkboard trivet and all, sitting atop a stack of Tomorrow's books, you know, the Tomorrow's folks, the alter ego back issue, those folks. I've got a decent sized library of Tomorrow's books. And that I recommend to anybody. They're really, really good stuff. Really fun. If you're a fan of comics history, I don't know that you could do much better. Besides listening to this program, of course. But I've got these books here. I've got them on the table next to me. The trivet on top of that. The microphone on top of that. So I don't have to contort to aim to the microphone. Like I said, this is a crappy folding table that I have, so I don't think if I would have gotten, like, one of those, arm attachments for the microphone, I'm pretty sure that would be heavier than the table, and it would probably flip it over. So, until I get a better table, or until I find out where I'm going to live permanently, this is how I'm gonna have to do it. But I don't know why I shared that. I guess I must have very, very little going on in my life. But hopefully this is an improvement in volume. And if anybody else is having a problem hearing me, please let me know. Like I said, I am not too audio technically proficient. I use Audacity and I just play with gain. I do know I use earbuds to hear, I use earbuds when I record. And I know the left one is always a lot lower than the right one, but it's always been that way. I don't know. If anybody out there can help, I am someone who needs help, clearly. So please help. Now, with that out of the way, let's get into today's book here. We are still in the Aftershock. We're just starting Aftershock, barely. It's part two. That's not numbered part two, but it is Aftershock, the second story we're reading. Wow, I am babbling today. Let's get into the damn book already. Today we are talking about Batman 555, which had a June 1998 cover date. The story is called Trapped Like Rats. It doesn't say Aftershock. I think Shadow of the Bat's going to be the only book that actually has Aftershock as part of the issue story title. This issue was written by Doug Mensch with pencils by John Beatty. Inks Sal Buscema, colors Gregory Wright and Android Images, letters Todd Klein, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.95. Now this one, I generally don't talk about the covers, but this one is especially eh. I mean, it's not a bad drawing, it's just, it's a pinup. It's, you know, Batman, it's just a shot of Batman with an orange background, You know, feels very much like something we'd get nowadays. So it kind of took me aback when I saw it, because so far, most of the covers have related to what is going on in the story, and this one is just a pinup. Anyway, we open in the Batcave, where Batman and Robin are trying to tow a giant, potentially load-bearing boulder out of the way in order to access the rocket tunnel. And hey, you might be saying, that's the thing that Doug Mensch spoke about in that wizard special we covered. And, you know, if I didn't know any better, I'd guess we're about to be getting a big old dollop of Ratcatcher. Then again, the story's called Trap Like Rat, so even I can put two and two together sometimes. Anyway, so the dynamic duo wrap a whole lot of chain around the boulder and use two entire Batmobiles to yoink it out of place. And they're successful. However, the Batmobiles are, well, they've seen better days. They're done for. And I tell you, I wish I were more familiar with, like, the various eras of Batmobile. Because I'm guessing that these two hold some sort of historical significance or were being referenced to specifically. Because they are differently shaped, so they do feel like they were from different eras. I'm just not familiar enough with them. So if anybody does know, please feel free to share with the class. Now, this rocket tunnel apparently ought to lead straight to the collapsed subway tunnels, where last we heard there were still upwards of tens of thousands of commuters still trapped. And so, in they go. Our scene then shifts to the siren of the night, Vesper Fairchild, on whatever station she talks on, WG something something, I'm sure. She's speaking about the trapped commuters, and she refers to their plight as being the most dramatic in the post-quake Gotham. And we're reminded that since the quake happened, quote, off-peak, there were less folks on board the trains than it would have been during rush hour. Of course, you remember, 7.03 p.m. She then reports that there are at least 19 deaths that occurred when two train cars were crushed. There are estimates that as many as a dozen riders were on board the last car, which was separated from the crashed and crushed train, and, well, those reports are right. She also reports that up until a day and a half ago, emergency workers were able to lower down food and drink to the survivors. However, due to another damned aftershock, the passageway was sealed off. Now, workers are a bit trepidatious about trying to excavate further, fearing a total collapse of whatever remains of these tunnels. Now, Vesper posits that this mishigash is turned into a one- or two-man job, and that's only if they can figure out a way in. Now that brings us back to Batman and Robin as they're loading into the Bat Subway rocket, whatever it is. Now they plan some strategy along the way, basically trying to figure out the most efficient way of getting where they're going. You know, with the least amount of explosives, the least amount of digging. They use a lot of exact terminology as to which stop on the subway they're going to get to, which doesn't mean anything to us, but it's cool that it's included. Meanwhile, hey, Ratcatcher. He's pontificating to his rat army, talking about how he used to be an exterminator and how he once killed rats by the thousand. But no longer. Now he sees man as the true vermin, or something like that. Now he speaks about being arrested for causing a single human death, which I guess he finds hypocritical. You know, because he did kill He killed so many rats and wasn't arrested for that. I don't know. All I do know is that the rats seem to be really eating this up. They're just chirp, chirp, chirping away here. They're loving the charisma of the rat catcher. Next, we check in on the survivors of that train, and we learn that they just finished up all their food reserves. So, things might be on the precipice of becoming uncomfortable. At that same time, Batman and Robin arrive at a dead end, and there's a load of debris on the tracks, so they're going to have to utilize some, you know, demolition tactics in order to get through. And, well, that's pretty much exactly what they do. While they're doing this, Robin does say something about how only something as thin as a jelly pancake can fit through, which makes me beg the question, what in the hell's a jelly pancake? That doesn't sound great. Anyway, Batman blows up the debris, the sound and reverb of which gets the attention of the nearby Ratcatcher, and so he heads off to find the source of it. Back with the boys, Robin asks Batman how they're going to get the commuters back to safety, to which Batman says, well, it looks like they're going to have to go back the same way they came. meaning he is fully prepared to strut everybody back through the Batcave, thus, you know, costing him a pretty big secret, right? Now, Tim is kind of taken aback and almost begins to protest, like, no, we can't do that, but Batman stops him. He says it's the only way. Either they traipse back through Wayne Manor, or these poor, you know, trapped commuters die. And he does go on to say that it doesn't matter. You know, the secret is immaterial. Batman will go on with or without the secret, with or without the Batcave, and even with or without him. Batman, the concept, the figure, the icon, will never die. He goes on to continue, citing recent guest Batmen, John Paul Valley during the Nightfall saga, Dick Grayson during Prodigal. And he says JP flat out didn't work. And Dick, well, he wasn't quite right either. He goes on to say that when the time comes, he hopes that Tim will be there to pick up the mantle. And Tim gives us a Keanu-esque whoa in response. Back to the survivors. The subway car they're all currently housed on has started to move a bit. They fear the worst, that they're about to fall into a chasm. One of the commuters looks out a window and sees the face of Batman, which, I tell you, might be scarier than the abyss. Robin lights a flare so everyone can get a better look at everything going on. Batman orders everyone out, telling them that they are literally teetering on the brink. Now, the passengers, they're all pretty gobsmacked, what with the urban legend currently stood before them. They're full of questions, mostly Quake-related. There are no time for answers, however, because the rat catcher cometh. And he's on a high platform above the train here, and he talks a lot. Like, he is very, very talkative. He says that it wasn't an earthquake that hit Gotham. Instead, it was judgment for man's arrogance. And he calls himself a master of the dark domain. He's got a rat army, yada, 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 yada. He calls Batman, quote, another rodent, which our hero corrects him on, because bats had been reclassified as primates. What? well, I'll be. There actually was, or is, it depends on what side of the argument you're on, there's a flying primate hypothesis. Now, this was introduced by a Swedish biologist and doctor, Carl Linnaeus, or Linnaeus, way back in 1758. Then it came up again in the mid-80s, like 1986, by an Australian neuroscientist named Jack Pettigrew. The hypothesis states that megabats, which is a subgroup of Chiroptera? I don't know how to say the word. Chiroptera, we'll say. They form an evolutionary sister group of primates. And this has been fiercely disputed by zoologists, and seems like at this point it's been mostly debunked. So, I guess, sorry, bats, and sorry, Batman. Now, Batman pretty much lets Ratcatcher ramble on and on and on, just so Tim can sneak up behind him. Unfortunately, before Tim can strike, the Ratcatcher toots on his rat whistle. Before we know it, several thousands of rats descend upon the roof of the subway car. And, I mean, this wasn't a great idea, because if you remember, this subway car was very literally teetering on the brink of an endless fall. And so, with the rats landing on it, the car finally gives way, so I guess, whoops. Smooth move, Flanagan. Now, luckily, all the innocent commuters had already deboarded, so no humans were hurt in the filming of this scene. Robin then uses his expanding bow staff to smack the baddie's gas gun out of his hand before whacking him over the railing. Batman proceeds to beat the hell out of the geek for about a page and a half before asking him how he managed to find his way to the subway. Well, Otis ain't telling. What's more, in the fall here, the rat killer gas wound up spraying everywhere. So time is kind of the essence. They gotta get these people out of the cloud. And so Batman removes Flanagan's mask, which makes him also susceptible to the toxin. And he finally agrees to escort Batman and the commuters back to the surface, thereby making it so Batman's secret can stay, well, you know, secret. We wrap up with Vesper Fairchild reporting that the survivors had been rescued, and that they claim their savior was the Batman. Though, she offers, they were all highly stressed and disoriented and, you know, breathing in rat poison, so they probably just thought it was the Fat Man. After all, you know, Batman's just as real as alien abductions. This is still the DC Universe, right? We have those happen daily, right? Anyway, now Batman and Robin, they're on to their next thing, and we close out with Otis Flanagan back behind bars. And that is where we leave it. Next time out, we're talking Detective Comics number 722. But for now, let's talk about what happened in this issue and maybe give some thoughts on it. I dug this. I dug this a lot. Though, I gotta say, I dug it kind of cautiously. Let me explain here. This was a good little story. It definitely fit the Aftershock mold. I just hope that, like, these next 16 or so issues and episodes aren't all like this. You know, and I mean, I'm being completely unfair, and I'm speculating. You know, nothing more than speculation. I've never read the Aftershock book, so this is baseless speculation. But, I mean, we've got several titles getting tied into this. We got Batman, we got Detective, we got Shadow, we got Robin, and we got Chronicles. Different books. Lots of different creators when we take the anthology into account. I just hope that we don't get, like, a couple dozen stories of Batman digging out survivors. You know? I mean, of course it's something that has to be done. I just don't know that I want to see that every single time out until we get to the road to No Man's Land. Hopefully there's more to this leg of our journey than that. And, you know, it's one of the things I... not so much complained about, but recognized and observed during Cataclysm was how, you know, I kind of sighed audibly when the Quake Master was introduced because it was like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess we are reading comics and yeah, we got to be reminded of comics and, oh, you know, it's comics. But had they not introduced the Quake Master, I wonder... like, it would have just been, I don't know, I think it would have been very samey. So it gave us something, it added a layer to the Quake and the Cataclysm. So while I don't know that I'm advocating for a nebulous big bad to be revealed and taken out during Aftershock, I don't know, I just hope there's more to it. Like, if it does turn out to be just Batman rescuing people, it does give... this era structure and uniformity in a way. But at the same time, I don't know, it'll give it a feel of being disjointed and episodic. Does that make sense? Maybe not. You know, I guess that's the difference between a branded crossover or just branding in general and a chapter by chapter event. Like Cataclysm, even though the chapters didn't completely work in as far as the order they were put in, but at least you knew, I don't know, that you were on a roadmap of sorts, whereas with this one it's just branding. Aftershock's just branding. I don't know if there is a hard and fast reading order. You know, we could we read all the Batman books, then read all the Shadow, and then read all the Detective books? Are they going to go into each other instead of throughout the line? I'm not sure. And this is one of the legs of the journey that it was hardest to kind of put in an order, you know, because I've looked at a number of different reading orders and some of them have them lumped by title, some of them have them lumped by month, some of them have months coming out of order. It's different. And speaking of the reading order, or just the project in general, when I started putting our roadmap together, I assumed... that the Aftershock era was going to be, I don't know, maybe a month or two worth of books. So I had it like pegged down to like maybe 6 or 8 chapters. It just didn't seem like the Aftershock branding was on that many books. And relative to No Man's Land, it is on very few. But so I figured it'd be like 6 to 8 chapters, which I think that sounds like a good amount of time to acclimate to the temporary new normal for Gotham City. See Batman doing things for... you know, people who are trapped and maybe not deal as much with villains. But there were like 15 or 16 of these. And again, it's totally unfair of me to speculate. and to project any sort of pessimism towards them, because I have not seen them, I have not read them. But I don't know, I mean, I guess I just hope that the era doesn't outstay its welcome. You know, I mean, Cataclysm, in my opinion, ran probably 4 or 5 chapters too long as it was. I feel like it could have, and potentially should have, been like a tight 12 issues, rather than like, what did we get, 17 and a half, if we count the prologue? Anyway, we will take each issue as they come, of course. So rather than continue down this spiral, how about we talk about a takeaway or two from this issue? Now, I think my biggest takeaway is something that has absolutely nothing to do with the earthquake, has nothing to do with Cataclysm or Aftershock. It's been so long since I'd popped in on, like, 90s Bat books in a measurable way. You know, back in the day when I would do the daily stuff at Chris's on Infinite Earths, occasionally a 90s Batman would, you know, fall beneath my eyes and I'd look at it. But I didn't really go for runs, you know. It was random, mostly. So it's been a long time since I've read Bat books from this era with an eye toward, I don't know, just reading them linearly. And that said, I'd forgotten how hard they were pushing the idea of Tim eventually being the one to take the Bat mantle. And this was always an interesting wrinkle to me. Not one I was ever completely on board with, but interesting all the same. It makes the Bruce and Tim relationship a bit different and a bit unique compared to Bruce and Dick, or even Bruce and Jason. I feel like Tim, as a potential heir apparent, was like kind of at play from the very start, whereas that always seemed less so in the cards for Dick. Now, of course, we know now that Tim didn't get the mantle during Bruce's brief flirtation with death. I never read Battle for the Cowl. That was a weird time. It came out when I was having my own flirtation with homelessness. Hell, I mean, I'd already made it to third base with homelessness, and the coach was waving me in at that point. After the fact, I found the Battle for the Cowl stuff a bit labyrinthine, maybe. I mean, there were one-shots, miniserieses, tie-ins. It just seemed like a lot. I never read, or out of character for me, I never even bought any of them. So I don't know if there was ever any serious discussion or consideration for Tim taking over the gig. Though there were different folks in the seats of power at DC at that time, so maybe it wasn't ever in the cards for the Dio era. Hell, I mean, we know he wanted to kill Nightwing during Infinite Crisis, so we don't know how he feels about Bat sidekicks. Or at least that was one of the more persistent rumors about Dan's tenure at the helm. Who knows? I mean, if anybody read and remembers Battle of the Cowl, please let me know if there was any kind of like real deal Tim talk in it. In any event, I thought this was probably the highlight of the issue for me, a very neat aside between Bruce and Tim. And I don't know if I gave it proper coverage in the synopsis, but the way it was presented was really, really interesting, because like Batman tells Tim that he hopes he can take the mantle one day, and this was like an earth-shattering revelation to Tim. You know, I joked that he said whoa, but like he was like literally taken aback here. The art in that scene was really nice. It, like, he was just facially awed and shocked. And on the other side of the conversation, it was said as like a pure statement of fact from Batman. Like, no emotion, no kind of like, you know, scruffing his hair, being like, yeah, one day it'll be you, kid. It was just a very, very blank statement. And I thought that was so cool that, I don't know, that Batman treats it that way. It's like, just like it's a, is fait accompli the right word? It's just the way it's going to be. And Tim just never even considered it. Like, it was this foregone conclusion from the start. I'm always a Dick takes over for Batman kind of guy. But I definitely appreciate this scene and this era. I mean, we've talked in the past about how DC in the mid to late 90s felt like a company and a universe on the move, right? It was maturing. It was aging. And it wasn't aging in a stodgy, you know, mothball kind of way. It was aging like a wine, you know. It was like these characters were growing up with us. I might be biased. I was a teenager at the time, so I was doing a lot of growing myself, but I don't know. It just felt like a very forward-moving, progressive sort of universe, and we bring in Tim, and it's just this foregone conclusion that, yeah, Tim, you're going to be the guy one day. It's, I don't know. It's a reminder of how things used to be, and I'm definitely, it's easy for me to become nostalgic, but I'm definitely nostalgic for this era, for sure. Now, the Ratcatcher stuff, let's talk about that. It was fine. It gave us some punchy, and he was probably the right villain of the month for this particular story and issue. I do think it was very creative in that it gave Batman a way out of, you know, traipsing the survivors back through the Batcave and Wayne Manor. And that's another very cool part of the story. You know, Batman has been very no-nonsense and to the point since, you know, getting out of the drink all those issues ago. Here we're presented with the fact that Batman's willing to risk the secret if it meant saving even one trapped Gothamite. The willingness with which Batman is willing to risk his long-kept secret really shines a light on how truly heroic he is. The secret is secondary to human life, as it should be. We often overlook that, I think, in comics here. I was on a Bronze Age kick years ago where everything was secondary to the secret identity, especially in Superman comics. You read a Superman comic from the 70s and into the early 80s even, and it always comes down to protecting the secret identity. And like every story, not every story, but most stories are like framed around that. It's like, how's he gonna get out of, you know, having the identity spilled here? And while I love those stories, and there's definitely a charm to that, there's a charm and an innocence and just a very comic booky thing about that, this is a different time and this is a different context. So it's really cool seeing Batman in an arena where he might have to practice the preach, you know? It's good stuff, real good stuff. So overall, while I am a teeny bit trepidatious that this Aftershock era will become rather repetitive, I definitely did enjoy this issue, and I'd be willing to bet a lot of Bat fans would too. This is almost like a, I don't know, time capsule issue. You know, all the context that we don't have anymore, but we did have then. It was good stuff. I liked it here, and I'm certainly looking forward to more cautiously. But I think that's about all I got to say about the issue. Before we hop out of here, let's hop into our NML bag here. We're going to start with a letter from our friend Eric. And he says, in regards to what was talked about in episode 17. And this is a comment I had made about being in a pretty dark place and considering just walking away from the hobby to the point where I was just going to give everything away. So Eric says, there were times I also wanted to get rid of my collection or sell some of it. But when I would go to list it on eBay or another site, I would take down the post because for some reason I just couldn't part with it. I would then try to say, well, I'll keep this stuff, but sell this other stuff, only to decide it's not worth it. I don't care about the money. It was all for my personal enjoyment. I sometimes think I should just drop it off at the front of the local comic shop for donation. I just want the books to go somewhere they could be appreciated and enjoyed by others. I would not want to see them thrown away or destroyed. And, you know, I'm with you. But when I had reached that point, I was, it was not a good time, but I was very close to just, is Craigslist still a thing? I don't even know if Craigslist is still a thing. I think I used Craigslist once to buy a video game back in like 2008. It's like I considered just putting up an ad saying like free comics, come get them. You know, I was just done. I didn't care if people were just going to take them and flip them, take them and, you know, sell them by the pound. It just didn't matter. That was a place I'm glad I'm not in anymore. But I think I think a lot of us go through that sort of thing, perhaps not to the extreme that I did. And maybe some people do it because they need money. They need the money for other things or other interests or for necessities. For me, I just didn't want to see them anymore. I'd walk into the room that I'm sitting in right now and I'd be like sick. I would be disgusted that I had all this stuff, and I'd grown like acrimonious towards it. Like it was an adversarial relationship with a hobby, and that's pathetic to say. And it's pathetic to acknowledge in me. But I'd see it and I would get mad. And I'd be just like, I wanted it gone. You know, a lot of that had to do with just the frame of mind I was in. And a lot of it also had to do with the fact that I used to, and I mean, I would not ever call anything I do transformative, like on the air or on the blog, but I felt like I was doing something. I was pseudo-producing something with my collection here. The collection became a multitasker. It became something I loved to read and something I loved to discuss and something I loved to analyze and study and become a fake-ass historian of. It became like a discipline in a way. And when I stepped away from the mic, I lost a big element of my fandom. My fandom had evolved, you know. I had posted a long time ago that I think I forgot how to read comics for fun. And that sucks to say, and it sucks that it's real. But I remember what it was here. I wanted to read I was getting back into the Fantastic Four, at least in theory. And I wanted to read The Reckoning War, which was a little, you know, little event they had back in probably 2021-ish. And I wanted to read it just for fun. I wanted to just check it out. And I started to read it, and I realized that, like, without the need to run off and write about it or talk about it, there was, like, no reason to do it. And that was a very depressing realization. And it, like, reframed what comics meant to me. Just that one little encounter that I had with my collection. I started questioning, like, why am I still buying this stuff? Why am I doing this? Why do I keep this stuff? It's not serving me. And, without going much deeper, I just came very close to a come and get 'em style post being made online to get this crap out the door, basically. Back to Eric. He says, I organize my comics by character timeline. For example, Red Hood is a series, miniseries, one-shots, and is a support character in other miniseries. I just file these books in the Red Hood timeline order. Especially that there are so many Bat-titled books or Bat-related books that I find this easiest for the current run of comics. And I think I definitely have an element of that in me as well. For example, my Nightwing long box, which I recently had to take apart because it was it overflowed, but used to be that I would put the Grayson series in between the New 52 Nightwing and the Rebirth Nightwing, because that's where it fits, you know, linearly. Since then, I've overfilled my Nightwing box, so Grayson is in its own box somewhere else with other Batman miniseries and whatnot. But I definitely enjoy hearing everybody's organizational processes and methods. I feel like mine are always kind of on a stop-start, because I have these ideas, but it's just a matter of actually doing it. And I keep flirting with the idea of transferring to the drawer boxes, if you're familiar with those. They're kind of like a regular long box with like a shell around it that you can pull, you know, the long box out of, so you don't have to move boxes to get to the ones below. And I keep thinking about doing that, and I even go as far as like placing an order, but then when I see the shipping cost, I recoil and don't, because I would need, at this point, I'd probably need like 125 long drawer boxes. And I think the last time I put an order in or tested an order, it was around, I think I wanted 110 long boxes. Because I guess they are just a little bit smaller than a regular long box. I guess you can fit just a few less books in each one, so I'd have to adjust the way I do things. But I remember the shipping cost was going to be something like $50 more than the boxes themselves. So, like, for easy math, we'll say it was $1,000 for the boxes. The shipping was $1,000 and $1,050. So I was like, holy cow. I've considered talking to local comic shops and seeing if I can, like, just add it to an order they have and just pay them a little extra. Because, I mean, they're getting them anyway. Who knows? We'll see what we can figure out one of these days. But until then, I'm just kind of cramming. It's hard to access a lot of these boxes. I've talked about how my setup is very, very X-specific. Like, the X-book boxes are on top because I needed to access them most often. So it's like, it's a disaster. It's a mess. Back to Eric. He says, another thing we have in common is that I'm also not a fan of Elseworlds and Dark Knight Returns. Hey, how about that? I do like things to be part of a main continuity. That's not to say some Elseworlds stories aren't good. It's just that I feel like, what does this matter when it's not in continuity? As for Dark Knight Returns, I've read it in the sequels. While I understand why people enjoy it so much, I find it's just not for me. But I seem to be at odds with people on a lot of the more popular stories. But I found over the years that it's okay to like some of the less popular stories as well. And I'm very much the same way, for sure. I know there's a lot of out-of-continuity stuff, especially with like the whatever the hell Black Label is at DC. I still don't know what that is. I mean, I know it's a thing, but I don't know what's what. I don't know if they're, I'd say real, but I mean, how real is anything? But I don't know if they're in continuity, their own continuity, a different Earth. Who knows? But it's like, I've heard a lot of good things about out-of-continuity stories. The one, I was just at the comic shop yesterday, and this dude was talking to the girl that worked there and said that he's a Marvel guy, but wants to expand into DC. And she's like, okay, well, tell me some of your favorite characters or characters you've heard of that you're interested in. And naturally, he said Batman, because of course, you're going to say Batman. And rather than, you know, send him to the trade shelves to start, you know, the current Zarsky stuff, or even the Tom King Rebirth stuff, or even the Snyder and Capullo stuff, she said, oh, you need to check out Batman White Knight, the Sean Murphy stuff. And it's like, that's, as far as I know, that ain't in any continuity. Or maybe it is, I don't know. But as far as I know, it's not quote-unquote real. To which I give it one look, and while I can appreciate it for being, you know, very pretty to look at, because it is, I can't care about it. You know, I don't know if it's just that I've hit an age where I'm too choosy, where I need things to matter, or if it's just something that's not for me. But yeah, the Elseworlds, the out-of-continuity stuff, I have a hard time with it myself. I'm sure I'm missing out. You know, I'm sure that I'd probably get some enjoyment. I'm sure people do get enjoyment out of these stories, probably more than the quote-unquote real stuff, because there's less restrictions and rules, and it's not cool to have to follow rules in comics anymore. So what are you going to do? And whenever I talk about Elseworlds, I always pop over to the Marvel side and do the what-ifs, too, because those were not great. In fact, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, it was right when the What If, Disney Plus, Hulu Plus, whatever the hell it is, there was a What If show, right? I never watched it, I would never watch it, but I know it's a thing. And somebody had tried to sell like an entire run of What Ifs to, not a comic shop, but like a random used bookstore nearby. And the bookstore didn't realize that this was a hot ticket at that point, didn't notice that these things could be sold for, you know, a decent amount of money, and they threw them in a 50-cent bin. And so I walked out of the shop that day, because, you know me, I can't leave a run behind. I think I bought 70 issues of What If for 50 cents. It was 40 cents each, because I have a discount at that store. But I went through them as I was logging them into my unwieldy Excel spreadsheet, and, like, there's there's a pattern in those books. It's always the end of the world. And, like, I think there was probably a set of rules at Marvel on how to write a what-if at some point in the mid-90s. It's like, okay, who's the hot character? Okay, now, what happens if Gambit forgets to brush his teeth one morning? Oh, the end of the world. Okay, well, what happens if Sabretooth stubs his toe on the way up the stairs? Oh, end of the world. It's always, like, the stupidest crap. I realize that this is, you know, very extreme and dismissive of them, and they were very talented people behind them, and I don't think they wanted to write stories where, you know, Peter Parker buys a different kind of coffee one day and the world ends, but that's what a lot of them turned out to be. Anyway, enough of me. Back to Eric. He says, similarly, I enjoy Batman's more serious and gloomy universe over a far more sunny Metropolis or Central City. I like that Batman's more of a detective and he's street level. Probably because Batman and his cast of characters are less about superpowers and more about cerebral and hand-to-hand combat. It adds to the realism when you see the characters getting stitched up by Alfred or Leslie over superheroes who get blasted and are instantly healed. He wraps up with, sorry about the long email, and thank you for always listening, and never ever apologize for long emails. I love the discussion, and I love that, I love the tangents they take me, talking about what if, I mean... Talk about tangents. But no, I do love all the emails and all the comments. It's always great stuff here. And to Eric's final point there, yeah, you know, there are sometimes I'm in the mood for the street level stuff. There are other times I'm, you know, I'm a big fan of Superman. You know, I am a big fan of the sunnier heroes from time to time. I do get into, like I've said, I get into kicks. You know, it's like, oh, I might be on a Superman kick, might be on a Batman kick, might be on, you know, across the street at Marvel, I might be on a Daredevil kick. It's that variety that, you know, makes this hobby so special, right? We can jump to different, in the same universe, the same month, the same week, we can read an issue of Superman, an issue of Batman, and they could be completely different, completely great in what they do, but they give you something a little different. But big thanks to Eric for writing in. I always appreciate hearing from you. Let's hop over to Chris Yu over at the blog. We're going to get a couple of comments from him and a response to something he said on the blog here. First, we're going to start with some comments about what we talked about in episode 7, where I was prattling on about volume numbers and how do we categorize books. Like, these weeds I get stuck in, I tell you. Chris says, for me, only ongoing series get a volume number. Limited series are categorized by year of publication, and just like one-shots. But if annuals are a part of those volumes, or separate series all on their own with their own volume numbers, that's another argument we don't need to get into. I think we do need to get into it, because I do have a lot to say about it, because I have a lot to say about a lot of silly things. But I used to file things the same way as Chris Yu here, where only the ongoings would get a volume number. You know, I would not give a volume number to a miniseries. I would just label them as miniseries. But then, like, we were getting multiple miniseries with the same names, and sometimes in the same year. So it was, like, really, really difficult to, for me, mentally, in my lizard brain, to figure out how to parse that. And I think that's what changed me to marking miniseries as volumes. And sometimes, like, even in the old Marvel books here, in the Indicia, they would label the volumes. That was a difference that always kind of annoyed me between Marvel and DC back in the long ago. DC would do volumes by year. So, like, if you had an issue of Superman from... when did Superman come out? 1938? Or Action Comics, say, 1938. If we read a book from 1978, it would show as Action Comics Volume 40, because it was the 40th year of the book, and then the issue number. Whereas Marvel would be different. You know, they would label things Volume 1, Volume 2. Sometimes it would continue from a miniseries, sometimes it wouldn't. Nowadays, everything's out the window, so who could tell? But that was what informed how I labeled things back in the day. It would be a mixture of the Indicia. I would never do the DC Indicia stuff. That would always, because that was silly. But I would use the Marvel Indicias, and I would use price guides, and then it got to the point where it's like I use the wikis, because the wikis are all over the place too. It's We can't get anybody to agree on how to do this. But regarding annuals, annuals were something that I would usually just lump in with whichever volume they were serving, right? So, like, in my unwieldy Excel spreadsheet, like, if it's, say, Action Comics Annual, it'd be Action Comics Annual, and then the volume number I would put, like, A1, you know, because it's the annual one. And then when they launch Action Comics Volume 2, you know, with the new 52, it was like, okay, so Action Comics Annual A2, Annual 2. It got kind of sticky when, like, they stopped, they annuals never went to a number 2. It was like, wow, we've got 5, you know, Action Comics Annual number 1s for the same volume. And Marvel's even worse with that. Marvel is, I think there's something like 7 or 8 Uncanny X-Men Annual 1s now. It's so silly here. So yeah, I don't have anything productive to add to the conversation, just my own silly addled anecdotes, but I definitely want to hear what you guys think. How do you guys label your annuals? Or are you smarter than me and you just use one of those collecting apps that puts it where it needs to go? Maybe that's the case. Let's hop back to Chris for a second message here. We're going to jump ahead to his comments on Detective Comics number 721. He says, I feel like the Quake Master storyline was just an excuse to have a bad guy to catch. The earthquake in Gotham idea is awesome, but Batman can't punch an earthquake. You can't put an earthquake behind bars either. Quake Master feels like an afterthought in the planning of this event, so Batman could just have a bad guy to catch. And that's true. That is true. I feel like, you know, I'm of two minds, because the Quake Master gimmick is pretty silly. And in some ways, it did take away from the emotional gravitas of the earthquake and the resulting decimation and damage. You know, it was like that weird reminder where we were shook back to the reality that we're reading a comic book. That said, we are dealing with a universe, a fantastical universe, with good guys and bad guys, heroes and villains, superpowers and, you know, mere mortals. So it would 100% stand to reason that a bad guy would try to claim credit for an earthquake. And that's exactly what we saw with the Quake Master here. He claims credit for it and he threatens more if he's not paid off. That makes perfect sense. So while I'm like not 100% a booster of the Quake Master, I gotta say it makes sense. It definitely makes sense to me. Plus, like I alluded to earlier, it might have helped to disguise the fact that the Cataclysm story ran a little long. Right? It gave us another layer to that story. Now, our friend CJ Standall, he would reply to this comment over at the blog as well. And he says, I agree completely, Chris Yu. I do think it's harder to have a natural disaster superhero story that has no supervillain, but I think it can be done. And I wish that this storyline had tried harder to do that. I also agree that the Quake Master seems like an afterthought. Regarding Quake Master's true identity, I do think it's clear in retrospect, as Chris Yu said in a previous post, but especially for newer readers or readers who don't have enough knowledge of Batman's rogue gallery, I don't think the clues work in the context of this crossover only. Because of that, I think this mystery is close to the territory that Chris Sheehan mentioned a few episodes ago, where it's like an old-school Victorian mystery that has a solution that works but isn't really something readers can solve with the clues at hand or only things in the story itself. Doyle's Sherlock stories do this a lot as well. I partly say this because when I first read this back when it came out in its first trade paperback collection, I had only read Nightfall, a scattering of other Batman comics, and had seen Batman the Animated Series. With this limited knowledge and the fact that I was a stupid 12-year-old at the time, I had no clue who the Quake Master was. When his true identity was revealed, I felt cheated, even though the clues were planted for those who know continuity. All this being said, I do understand that stories in a shared universe do and should use continuity that newer readers might not know. But I think that a better story uses these things in a way that enhances the story without sacrificing or taking away something from the casual reader. In this case, I think it does enhance the story on rereading, or on first reading for those who know continuity pretty well. But I think it takes away too much from the new and casual reader on first reading as far as solving the mystery goes. I think this mystery could have been better if they had if they had the existing clues, but also added ones that a newer or casual reader might be able to use. Ultimately, though, I'd prefer they didn't have this Quakemaster storyline at all. And I wanted to share these two letters in a row here because my own, like, cognitive dissonance over the Quakemaster is pretty much on display here. Because, you know, I know that I probably sound hypocritical when I say that. I don't know if I said this on the air or not, or if I just said this to someone in passing, but the clues we got outside of the inability to say words with the letter B in it, which wasn't entirely clear from the reading anyway. I'm sure looking back on it, it would be obvious. But they seemed a little bit obscure, right? And that's just to me. And like I said, I'm oftentimes dense when it comes to following a story. But it makes me feel like a hypocrite because I usually applaud use of continuity. And I know that, especially nowadays, that gets frowned upon and it's looked at as gatekeeping or whatever you want to call it. But at the end of the day, I feel like the readers, the loyal readers, the people who followed these characters and these stories need or should be rewarded for it. So if someone saw the clues and was able to be like, oh, that was the ventriloquist, I knew it. I knew it from the start. More power to them. That's great. I think that's super cool. It pays off. It pays forward your loyalty, you know? I think that's very satisfying when stuff like that happens. Unfortunately, on the other hand, we're launching a very big Batman crossover, which is being promoted as being a very, very important story, which means to me, you're going to get a lot of new eyes. You know, you're going to get a lot of bat-curious people jumping in. And you might get people who only read Robin, who will be like, oh, well, how does this tie in? And they'll start reading all the books. So I think in that regard, and I sound like a complete hypocrite, but maybe, like CJ said, maybe drop some easier hints in there. Maybe drop something a little bit easier to glom onto and make guesses, right? Then again, I might be saying that through the current year prism, where people aren't expected to do any research. In fact, the potentiality of having to do research is a deterrent. You know, people complain all the time about how insane certain continuities are, and they celebrate when continuity goes away. So it's, I don't know, it's different times. Back then, and I hate saying back then, but back then it feels like if we wanted to know, there was like an intrinsic bit to it to where we would actually go and research. We wanted to learn about these characters. When anytime Reggie and I would discuss a Mark Waid book on the Cosmic Treadmill, we would go through his biography and we would make little changes to it every now and again. But the one thing we always made sure to keep is that growing up, Mark Waid had like a bank of index cards where he kept continuity straight. And he was like his own trading card collection with stories, with characters, with events, all stuff to help him keep things straight. And so he could refer to it whenever discussing those characters or stories or events. And I don't know, I feel like that's not the way things are anymore. The information is so easy to come by now that nobody cares enough to do it. It's like we don't value it anymore. Like, if everything's just a Google search away, and all of it's going to contradict itself anyway, what's even the point? Boy, there's another tangent I wasn't planning to go down. This is a even more tangent-laden than usual episode, isn't it? But I do want to thank both Chris's for writing in and chatting up the Quakemaster here. I wouldn't say it's a divisive topic, but it's definitely one that we can ponder. And it's fun to do that kind of thing. It's the old comic shop chat sort of vibe. So I do like that. I do want to close out with CJ's last line here. He says, got a side note here. We got so many Chris's here. And I say that as a Chris myself and a Chris S to boot. Both Chris's. Thanks for the lively discussion. And Chris's are kind of a dying breed, but there are a lot of us out there. And I guess that's a pretty decent segue for me to invite anybody, Chris or otherwise, to join in on the conversation. You could find me several different ways. You could find me on, how do I usually start this? WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, 90sXmen on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter. On that note, let's take this one home here. I want to wish everyone a wonderful weekend, which I guess dates this episode. And of course, thank you all so, so much for sharing a little bit of your day with me. Till next time, as always, talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to